The court calls case 24-40447. The General Land Office of the State of Texas, Don Buckingham, Commissioner Medical Doctor, versus Donald J. Trump in his official capacity as President of the United States, et al., versus Randy Kinder Excavating, Incorporating, doing business as RKE Contractors, et al. You may see that there are only two judges on the bench. Judge Ho will be participating in the case, but not in the oral argument. Are the parties ready to proceed?
All right.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. The district court erred under Rule 21 and denied intervention to three border wall contractors who are seeking to intervene in this case. The district court made two findings that contravene this court's case law.
Wait a minute, hold on. Is this the docket sheet for today?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so. I'm sorry, there are parties, and I'm trying to figure out. You are representing the land office.
No, ma'am. Sumner Fortenberry on behalf of Randy Kinder Excavating, Southern Border Constructors, and I'm.
Yes, you are, I was going to say. Check. I'm glad I asked.
Yes, ma'am. The case captions can be a little difficult to follow on this one. The district court erred when it concluded that the border wall contractors' motions to intervene were untimely. This court made clear nearly 50 years ago in the Stallworth decision that timeliness under Rule 24 is governed by a four-factor test. The first factor is the touchstone of the analysis, and it asks the trial court to consider the amount of time in between a putative intervener's learning of its interest in a case or when the learning of when the existing parties no longer represented that interest and when it moves to intervene. Here, that date is clear. It's March 28, 2024, when the border wall contractors each received form correspondence from the federal government purporting to apply a preliminary injunction in the district court case to their border wall contracts, or task orders, as you might hear me call them. That letter was the first time the border wall contractors knew that their interests were meaningfully impacted in this case. And under similar case law, note to the court, Sierra Club v. Espy, a 1994 decision, a letter from a federal agency purporting to apply a preliminary injunction to a particular contract is a starting point for the timeliness inquiry under Rule 24. The district court's contrary conclusion ran astray on several points. First and foremost, the district court arguably didn't consider the factor at all. Instead, it, quote, started with the second of the four timeliness factors. But that's not really how it works. The district court assumed that the intervention was late before proceeding to the prejudice analysis. But Stallworth and its progeny teach that you have to first decide when the putative intervener learned of its interest or learned that the existing parties no longer represented that interest. By not doing that, the rest of the analysis was necessarily infirm. But let's assume, as my friends on the other side are likely to point this court to the district court's musing that the border wall contractors should have intervened at the inception of this case when a motion to dismiss was filed. This is incorrect for several reasons. First and foremost, this court has repeatedly and recently instructed that at the outset of a case, interveners can't have knowledge of their interest in the lawsuit, and you waste judicial resources by encouraging their premature intervention. That's the Hernandez decision from 2023. Even in the permissive intervention context, that rule remains the same. Here, that's all the more so. The border wall contractors continued to negotiate with the federal government following the termination of their border wall contracts when President Biden entered office, just as though nothing in this lawsuit could possibly affect those negotiations. Now, it's important here to understand something about those negotiations. This is a government contract that was terminated for convenience, and when that happens, the contractor has a corresponding right from the federal government to the prompt negotiation and settlement of their border wall contracts. That process continued unabated until March 28, 2024. And so that was when the border wall contractors knew of their interest. Indeed, Texas Sterling Construction, one of my three contractors, received their task order after this litigation had begun. It makes little sense that they wouldn't have known at the start of this lawsuit that their interests were impaired. Finally, I'd also note that the district court did not meaningfully analyze at all whether the federal government was at any point when it ceased to represent the border wall contractors' interests. And again, it did so. There was no point throughout the three-year negotiation period where the border wall contractors ever received word from the federal government that it would stop negotiating with them or not pay them for their border wall construction. So there's no analysis in the district court's order suggesting that the federal government ever ceased to represent their interests until the issuance of that letter. Finally, I would note that the district court's order is rife with reference to considerations that Stallworth explicitly disavowed. The district court repeatedly referred to the pendency of the litigation, nearly three years long, the fact that the litigation was broadly publicized. Stallworth and multiple cases that have followed it have taught that the pendency of the litigation has little to do with whether or not the border wall contractors would have known of their interests, and they certainly didn't hear. Now, turning briefly to the other of the three timeliness factors, the second factor, prejudice, as I've suggested, was unmoored from the proper starting point. So the district court's prejudice analysis considered the pendency of the litigation when measuring the prejudice to the existing parties. But under Stallworth and Espy and their progeny, that was inappropriate. The only prejudice that was measurable was from March 28th to when the border wall contractors moved to intervene, mere days or weeks after that letter. The third factor, the prejudice to the border wall contractors should they not be allowed to intervene, also supports intervention. The district court made one paragraph finding on this point. It said that the border wall contractors could just file separate lawsuits so their interests couldn't possibly be impaired. That's not persuasive for several reasons that I'll discuss a little bit more fully when I get to the third factor of the overarching intervention test, practical impairment, but suffice it to say for the time being that this court has held that the mere ability to bring a separate lawsuit does not foreclose intervention. Now, moving on to the fourth factor of the timeliness analysis, unusual circumstances. The district court found that because this case was on the, quote, doorstep of final judgment, that it was an unusual case for us to attempt to intervene at that juncture. Again, this court's case law has expressly rejected that argument. In 2005, in the Ross v. Marshall case, the court made it very clear that when two parties get together and refuse to appeal an otherwise final judgment, that's unusual circumstances cutting in favor of intervention, not against it. And so much more so here, where the border wall contractors have effectively been cut out of the process while the federal government and the states continue to ask the district court to modify the injunction. Now, I'll turn briefly to the second finding that the district court made, namely that under the third factor of the intervention test, our interests were not impaired. Again, the district court, single paragraph of analysis, we could have filed separate lawsuits. Again, this court in the CNA Metals decision, a Judge Jolly case from 2019, made it very clear that the liberal intervention standard will not foreclose intervention simply because a separate lawsuit can be filed. And you'll note in our papers we cite case law from the D.C. Circuit, the Third Circuit, the Eighth Circuit, and a very good opinion from Judge Rosenthal of the Southern District of Texas, all suggesting that the mere ability to file a separate lawsuit is insufficient to deny intervention.
Mr. Fortenberry, if your client proceeded in a separate proceeding, could that court, and if the court found your client's claims meritorious, could that court award relief that does not conflict with the preliminary injunction?
Your Honor, I think that it's possible that they could award relief, but it's exceedingly unlikely that an administrative law judge is going to be willing to reinterpret an Article III district court injunction that's now been finalized, that the federal government insists preclude it from fulfilling its contractual obligations. And we think that because we've cited some cases in our papers to this effect, but we have notice of this injunction. So arguably, by going before an administrative law judge, we potentially risk putting ourselves and the federal government in contempt of it. Now, we don't believe that we're completely foreclosed from pursuing that relief, but we also believe that practical impairment doesn't require complete foreclosure of that relief. And I think the case law makes that quite clear, specifically in CNA Metals and its progeny. I think importantly for us, Your Honor, and I see my time is about to run out, but our border wall contractors are currently incurring tens of thousands of dollars a month in costs that they can't recoup because they were denied intervention in this case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. And I see that you've reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Donati.
Good Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. David Donati with the Sierra Club Interveners. This court said, in Stallworth, that a rule fixing timeliness to the pendency of litigation would induce both too much and too little intervention. It would encourage often unnecessary intervention at the start of a case when the stakes of that litigation were unclear, and it would prevent parties from intervening later when the impact on their rights became clear. Quote, these effects would be inconsistent with two important purposes of Rule 24, to foster economy of judicial administration and to protect non-parties from having their interests adversely affected by litigation conducted without their participation. As Mr. Fortenberry ably described, the district court erred on timeliness on each of the four Stallworth factors, as well as in finding that we had no practical impairment or impediment to our ability to protect our interest. Moreover, not only is our right to intervene clear, but now that the federal government has chosen not to appeal, and both parties have returned to the district court on opposing motions related to the injunction, this court must reverse so that we may seek the narrow relief that we need. I'm going to come back to timeliness, but I'd like to start where Mr. Fortenberry left off on impairment or impediment. The district court acknowledged that we have a legally protectable interest in the GLO litigation. Our circumstances are, as far as I can tell, unique. In July of 2023, we settled five-year-old litigation with the federal government, and that settlement committed no money to my clients. What that settlement did is it committed the federal government to undertake specific projects, and in that settlement agreement, the federal government said that those projects would be funded exclusively by the fiscal year 2020 and 2021 barrier system appropriations, quote, subject to the availability of those funds. The federal government represented at that time that those funds were available, and it committed expressly over and over that it would take reasonable steps to ensure that they remained so. Between July of 2023 and March of 2024, there was no juridically significant event in the GLO litigation. The funds were available, the federal government was performing under our contract, undertaking the projects that it had committed to undertake. We learned of the GLO injunction, like the border wall contractors, vis-a-vis notice from the federal government. It said, we are exploring the scope and impact of this injunction, and in the interim, we are stopping work on your projects. We do not know what we are going to do with this injunction at this time. We moved to intervene just 1 month later. This court has held that similar intervention following a preliminary injunction is timely. You don't have to look very far to see that Sierra Club versus SB is a closely analogous case to this one. But I promised I would start at practical impairment and impediment. The district court held essentially two things, and it did so on Stallworth Factor 3, prejudice to us, as well as impairment or impediment. On Stallworth Factor 3, it said those interveners who are interested in getting paid in general may access different forms of money, or we could simply go to a different court to vindicate our interests. The problem is, and the district court expressly did not reference us, we are not entitled to money from the federal government. We are not interested in getting paid in general. And in fact, if we go to another venue, in this case, the Northern District of California, the federal government can and will waive the GLO injunction to the district court and say the funds that are required for performance are restricted by the GLO injunction. That is at least practical impairment or impediment. And several of this court's cases have acknowledged even more hypothetical or speculative forms of impairment to satisfy that requirement. In Sierra Club versus SB, it was the possibility that a judgment could be used in different proceedings was enough to satisfy practical impairment or impediment. Sierra Club versus Glickman was a similar circumstance. In John Doe versus Glickman, this court said the same thing. In Ford versus City of Huntsville, over and over again, the courts have said that the ability to go to another court may not negate practical impairment or impediment when the judgment of one court, here the court that issued an injunction restricting nationwide and on a forward-looking basis billions of dollars of appropriation, the federal government can and will go to any court that we choose to avail ourselves of and say these funds are unavailable. We are not gonna, my apologies, go ahead, Judge.
You've argued that The preliminary injunction restricts the largest category of funds identified in the settlement agreement and the only funds identified by the government as available for performance. Are there any other funds that are available for performance?
Not to our knowledge, Your Honor, and this is something we tried to work with the federal government on. We said, are there any funds that you could find that would allow you to conduct the performance that we need? And the federal government has said no. So as a practical matter, there is certainly impairment or impediment. Whether as a legal matter, they could dig through the federal treasury and find other money, I'm not sure. But certainly our ability to claim relief in another court is at best limited or restricted by the GLO injunction here. Now, I think that there is a question that the states raise in their brief, but not the federal government, as to, well, what about the subcategories in the barrier system appropriations? And could those be used for your settlement agreement? The federal government has said no to us. We think that should be enough. And that question could better be put to the federal government, but my understanding from their briefing when they moved to modify the injunction last November is that every single one of those categories has either expired or dried up. And in any event, we're talking about orders of magnitude difference between the A1 funds and every other fund that would be available. The practical impairment and impediment here is abundantly clear, certainly in our circumstances. No matter where we go, the GLO injunction would follow us, and that's why we believe that the district court here is best situated to give us the very narrow relief that we seek. We don't want to relitigate the entire case. We disagree with the federal government on many of the positions that it took below, but we do believe that insofar as the federal government undertook specific obligations to us, that the district court's injunction, whether the preliminary or the permanent injunction, because we moved to intervene long before permanent relief was granted, long before the federal government declined to appeal, long before the parties went back to the court on opposing motions for an injunction, to modify the injunction, one of which was granted just this month by the district court, we would ask the district court to modify the injunction to allow for its narrow obligations already undertaken to us to be exempted from the permanent injunction. It's as simple as that. And if that's not enough for the parties, then we would work with the district court to figure out a way forward. But what's clear, Your Honors, is that the district court's order is rife with legal and practical errors that this court has reversed on. Mr. Fortenberry ably went through them. It fixed timeliness to the pendency of litigation. It said the filing of the motion to dismiss. We didn't have an interest then, and the only thing a motion to dismiss says is that the federal government will defend. It determined prejudice based on the long-running stature of this litigation, but found none particular to delay. It ignored the prejudice to us, and it construed incorrect circumstances, namely that the federal government was a party, to be unusual. We litigate against the federal government all the time and have opposed intervention in cases against the federal government, and this court said in Sierra Club versus SB, that's not an unusual circumstance. Thank you.
Thank you, and I see that you've also reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal. Right, Mr. Los Santos.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Josh DeSantos on behalf of the United States. I just want to jump in and address one of the Your Honor's questions during my friend's on the other side time. As to the contractors, they can get paid by bringing CDA claims under the Contracts Disputes Act. So what they would need to do is just follow the procedures there and either go to the Agency Board of Contract Appeals or the Court of Federal Claims. And they say, we are owed money under the CDA. Once they get a judgment, that judgment would be paid from the judgment fund. The judgment fund is there to pay when other appropriations are not available, and they can be paid for whatever they are actually owed. So long as they bring procedurally correct claims for work that they are owed money for, they can get paid. They do not need to be in the suit to get paid. On the other issues, we stand on our briefs. I would just like to take any questions that the court may have.
Did the district court make any explicit findings about when the would-be interveners became aware or should have become aware that their interests were no longer protected?
So what the district court said was they should have intervened closer to the inception or all the way through the appeal and remand. I think what it meant there was in response to what the intervention motions said. So I think it's important when you're looking at an abuse of discretion standard, you have to see what was before the district court. In the intervention motions that were filed, what the interveners said was, we need to appeal because the federal government is not making these project-specific arguments about our particular projects. We want to carve them out, and the federal government is not making those arguments. That had been true for 3 years. And what the district court was saying was, this case has been briefed to death. I think it said at a prior hearing, it had been so many different levels of briefing before this court as well. And then once it was remanded in June 2023, then it undertook like two or three rounds of briefing in the district court with a hearing about the meaning of the appropriations and what it could be spent on. And then for them to come in and say, oh, but the government isn't making our project-specific arguments, they should have known that before, because that had been true all along. And in particular with Sierra Club, they say in their motion and before this court, they knew of their interest in these particular funds in July of 2023, that is 9 months before, because that's when they entered into the settlement agreement that said, the remediation you're getting will be paid from these particular funds. It was no secret that these funds were the subject of this lawsuit. So I think that's what the district court was responding to when it said, therefore, you know, they should have come in closer to when all of these briefings were taking place about what the party's positions were on how to use this money.
Did the federal government previously assert that all spending under the appropriations bill was appropriate? And if so, why would they have needed to worry about carve-outs?
Well, what I'm saying is that was their theory of intervention that they presented to the district court in their motions. They said, the government is not making our project-specific ones. They are making a more general argument about the use of appropriations. But we need to intervene because they haven't made our arguments. And that had been true all along.
What about the statements in the motion for extension of time that the government was working diligently to assess the full range of contracting and fiscal actions required to comply? Why isn't that consistent with what Mr. Fortenberry told us earlier about continuing the negotiations?
Well, I'm sorry, the extension motion in the district court, I think, is what you're referring to.
Yes.
So that was not so much about negotiations with the contractors. It was about the government was assessing how to comply with the district court's injunction. If anything, that should have put everybody on notice, right, that the government was about to start complying with the very broad injunction that the plaintiffs had received in this case about the use of these funds. So I don't think that cuts in their favor.
Well, if you specifically use the language, full range of contracting and fiscal actions required, why wouldn't they think that included them?
Well, so what the government is referring to there is to comply with the injunction, the government was going to have to suspend a bunch of different work in different contracts that didn't comply, right? So that would include the kinds of actions that later led to the contractors not receiving the payment, right? So that it was something adverse to their interests. Is what that's referring to. Because it would be complying with the injunction that's saying you can't use this money for all these other things. Is that clear? So in other words, the government was saying, you, district court, told us that we can only use the money to like build actual new wall, and we are using the money for other incidental things, and then we're going to have to take a number of actions to comply with your order, because we'll have to tell the contractors stop working and then tell them we can't pay them and so forth.
And we're still talking about when the proposed or would-be interveners became aware or should have become aware. If the motion for extension of time was filed on March 14th and it says we're working diligently to assess the full range of contracting and fiscal actions required to comply, and then 2 weeks later on March 28th, the letters are sent to the contractors. Why isn't that consistent with what Mr. Fortenberry said?
So I'm not quite sure what Your Honor's getting at. I think what we're saying is once the preliminary injunction came in and the government was saying it was complying with this very broad injunction that basically said you can only use money to like build new wall, to paraphrase, once that came in, right, anyone that was going to that had interest in money that that was going to something that was not such a project, you know, would have been unnoticed. But let me just back up as well and just say, you know, our point here is a narrow one, which is just that under the abusive discretion standard and the intervention motions that the district court was reviewing, what the district court decided in the unique circumstances of this case was not an abuse of discretion.
Well, let's talk about the second timeliness factor, the interest relating to the party. Both the contractors through their contracts and the Sierra Club interveners through their settlement agreement had contractual interests. Why don't those suffice to satisfy the second factor?
You're saying that they would be prejudiced, that factor?
Well, the district court relied on the first and third timeliness factors. I don't see that the district court addressed the second factor. Would you agree?
No, I believe the district court addressed all of the factors, Your Honor.
All right. Well, then let me ask my question again. Do the contractual interests suffice to satisfy the second timeliness factor?
It might be that Your Honor is asking about the other intervention factors rather than the timeliness factors. We haven't participated on like the whether they have a significant enough interest.
I am talking about the second factor for intervention as a matter of right. You're correct.
Right. We haven't taken issue with those factors. We've only said that their interests are not practically impaired. For the reasons that I started out with, the contractors can get paid by getting the judgment, and then our brief addresses the Sierra Club. And then on timeliness, just that it was not an abuse of discretion under the circumstances of this case.
I'd like for you to address the same question I asked of the other side. If they proceeded in different courts, in different proceedings, and the courts found that their claims were meritorious, could those courts award relief that does not conflict with the preliminary injunction entered by the district court below?
Yes, absolutely. So as I started out with for the contractors, they just need to file the procedures of the Contracts Disputes Act. And they would go to either the Court of Federal Claims or an agency board of contract appeals, and they would say, we are owed money, and the government has not paid us. And at that point, the injunction is not... We are not saying that the injunction would prevent them from getting a judgment so long as they are following the procedures of the Contracts Disputes Act and actually requesting money that they are owed. They would get a judgment, and that can be paid from the judgment fund. It would not have anything to do with the appropriations at issue here for purposes of their payment. There would be no need to interpret the district court's injunction or anything like that before the Court of Federal Claims or the Agency Board of Contract Appeals. And as to Sierra Club, what we've said is they can invoke... They came in saying, our interest here is the government's compliance with our settlement agreement. And what we're saying is, their settlement agreement says, if you have a dispute about compliance, you follow these procedures, which are, you can ask the district court to revive your claims.
I'm set.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Sam Friedland on behalf of Plaintiff Appellees. I want to address just a couple points on the timeliness factor briefly. I think one thing that's important to ground all the discussion between the parties is that timeliness is measured from when the putative intervener should have known that their interests may be affected rather than when their interests actually were affected. And that's this court's Summers v. Bank of America case. It's when they should have known that they had an interest in this case. This case was originally filed in October and December of 2021. And since that moment, plaintiff appellees have sought the same injunctive relief. So this injunctive relief has continued. It's hundreds of pages of briefing. It went up to this court, it came back down. And when it came back down, the court back in 2023 said that the district court should act expeditiously on this injunctive relief. In the face of that, which I believe that the district court properly exercises discretion in recognizing, Each appellant tries to pivot and instead argue that they reasonably believe that the government was representing their interests until such time as they decided to move to intervene. I think it's important for the court to be aware the record and history of this case demonstrates that all of these are merely pretextual excuses for their late, multi-year late intervention. So looking first at the border wall contractors, the trigger, if you will, that the border wall contractors rely on is the date that they received the letter from the government saying we are complying with our interpretation of the injunction. Now there's nothing in this letter that suggests that the government was changing its position with respect to the border wall contractors' projects. This was a letter issued after a hotly contested multi-year preliminary injunction was ultimately entered. Sierra Club, meanwhile, relies on the government moving to transform the preliminary injunction into the permanent injunction as its trigger for when it thinks timeliness should start, because it claims it was not aware at that point that the government was, or it became aware, excuse me, at that point that it believed the government was no longer representing its interests. Again, this was an agreement by the parties to ask the court to transfer it to a permanent injunction without prejudice of the right to appeal. So at that point, there was no representation that the federal government was diverging in its positions at sufficient to start a timeliness clock, especially under this court's abuse of discretion review of the district court's decision. All appellants have referenced today this court's Sierra Club v. Espy decision as the basis saying, well, after preliminary injunctions have been entered, we can still move to intervene. I think Espy, as we lay out in our briefing, actually strongly demonstrates the error in their timeliness analysis, because as this court observed in Espy, the basis for the intervention wasn't that the injunction was entered previously, but that the, quote, status of the claims changed dramatically over the course of this lawsuit, end quote, which meant that the interveners had no reason to believe their interests were not adversely affected earlier. As I've said, nothing about this, the injunction sought has changed. If anything, the district court issued a more narrow injunction than plaintiff appellees sought. Plaintiff appellees asked for an injunction that in part halted the improper use of 209A1 funds, and then in part asked for the government to be directed or to spend the funds in certain ways. The district court granted the first, denied the second. This has been injunctive relief that has been sought for years. I also want to go briefly onto what I, or I should say, move on to what I believe is the most direct way with which the court can and should affirm the judgment of the district court, which is that appellants have failed to establish any impairment or impediment of their ability to protect their interests. As this court heard the government say today, the parties are free to seek payment from other sources. And that's really all the parties, the appellants here care about. I mean, border wall contractors want payment on their funds. Sierra Club wants the government to spend money on its desired projects. All of these are alternative avenues that may be exercised. Now, the border wall contractors hang their hat on the CNA Metals case. I think CNA Metals case is clearly not only distinguishable, but frankly doesn't have much of anything to do with this case, because CNA Metals was a case where you had parties fighting over a pot of money, and then an attorney who had a contingency agreement that entitled them to a portion of that money wanted to intervene to get their portion of the pot. That's what CNA Metals was. This is a case where parties seek to intervene to carve out specific projects of an injunction. It seems to increase their negotiating position for later lawsuits seeking the recovery of money that they're ultimately claiming they are entitled for. Now, each of these appellants really only argues that they may be affected by downstream spending decisions in the federal government in response to the APA action. But I think it's also important to stress that adopting appellant's novel construction of Rule 24A, and specifically whether an interest is impaired sufficient to satisfy Rule 24A, would result, frankly, in innumerable spiraling delays of APA actions from constant third-party intervention. This case was a legal and constitutional question about the meaning of certain appropriations language. Every APA action may affect numerous downstream contracts. To allow parties to constantly intervene to raise their own fact-specific contract claims in any action would result in courts engaged in constant mini-trials. I mean, and the district court found, and appellants lightly resist, but don't provide any strong argument resisting the fact that what appellants are seeking to do is inject innumerable fact-based questions into this action. Border wall contractors want to argue that very particular projects should be carved out, that they weren't paid for them, that they're entitled to X amount of money. Sierra Club wants to argue that its settlement agreements or specific projects should be carved out or still entitled to funds. All of these are incredibly downstream from the ultimate question before the district court, which is how do you interpret 209A1? It is also not even clear what appellants could intervene to challenge at this point. So prior to intervention, the district court made extensive legal conclusions about the appropriate scope of the language contained in 209A1. As plaintiff appellees note in our response brief, even if appellants successfully intervened at this point, they are required to take the case as they find it. The district court has made these legal conclusions as to the scope of 209A1, and nothing in this case that the district court could rule further would affect appellant's interests. I also want to talk briefly, I think there's a couple additional deficiencies in Sierra Club's argument that I want to briefly address. So first, Sierra Club claims a contractual interest in the underlying proceedings arising from its negotiated settlement with the federal defendants. As we detail in our brief, the contract issue only gives Sierra Club a contingent interest in any contractual right it may have. This is critical because other courts, and we cite some of these examples in our briefing, have found that contingent contractual interests are insufficient to satisfy Rule 24A2. The other deficiency in Sierra Club's motion specifically is that it has failed to demonstrate that this district court in Texas would even have jurisdiction to affect Sierra Club's interests relating to the settlement agreement or with the federal government. So the Northern District of California still, and by my math, for another three and a half years, retains jurisdictions over any disputes with the federal government involving Sierra Club's settlement agreement. So it's not clear that the district court is with jurisdiction to issue any relief that Sierra Club seeks. Unless there are any other questions from the court, we rest on our briefs.
I do have some questions.
Yes, sir.
Mr. DeSantos says that his client is not contesting the second factor under the four-factor test for intervention as a matter of right. What is your client's position?
We contested it before the district court. We didn't brief it on appeal. We focused on the two bases by which the district court found that there was an intervention. I believe I heard one of my friends on the other side say that the district court found that the second satisfied. I don't read the district court's opinion as saying as such. I believe it at least said at least they didn't satisfy elements one and three of intervention.
What about the fourth factor? It appears that no one has argued that the would-be interveners failed to meet this requirement. Would you agree?
I would agree that we did not argue that those issues on appeal. We argued it before the district court, not before this court.
So only at issue are the first and third factors, and you've told us that you think the third is the most important.
I would say only at issue for this appeal. I think that if the court sent this decision back down, there's a couple other open questions which the district court identified but declined to rule on. We talk very briefly about appellant's failure to satisfy Rule 24C, some of these different elements, but I would agree that those are the only issues before this court on appeal.
Does the analysis for the third factor under Rule 24A2 mirror the third Stallworth factor for timeliness?
May I answer that question? I think it generally does. I think, if anything, there's a couple cases that say that analyze the third factor and find that the third factor of Stallworth is more, quote unquote, is to an even greater degree not met if there's these alternative remedies. But I think it's generally a one-to-one comparison.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Judge Key? Thank you.
Your Honor, a few brief points in my 2 minutes. Both sides suggested that we, quote, could be paid as long as we went to the Court of Federal Claims, initiated a lawsuit, and litigated for multiple years for monies that we were about to receive without any litigation at all. This is a case where there is practical impairment because we went from a party that didn't have to file a lawsuit to a party that's told that we need to litigate against the federal government, maybe one day obtain a judgment, and then get that money out of the judgment fund. There is no case law in this court that suggests that that's a requirement under the third factor of Stallworth. I'd also point the court briefly to the standard of review. I heard a lot of abuse of discretion talk. Intervention is reviewed de novo. There is case law in this court suggesting that timeliness is reviewed for abuse of discretion when there is such a finding. To the extent the district court made one, it contravenes Stallworth in multiple respects, which means that this abuse of discretion of review is necessarily an abuse of discretion because of the legal errors. There's a footnote in my brief to that effect. Also, this talk about the finality of the district court's order and how we all should have known in the beginning of this lawsuit how this was going to affect us is belied by the record. The district court was moved by the federal government to clarify its injunction in the days after the March 8th injunction came down, and the federal government itself didn't know that what we were looking for, namely use of the border wall funds to conclude our contract administration, that's all the border wall contractors need. Barrier system funds should be allowed to be used on barrier system contract administration. My guys built border wall, they're still storing border wall. They might be asked to put up border wall again in the future, but in this particular instance, this injunction and the initial requested relief, which to be clear, asked for the reinstatement of our contracts, did not put us on notice that we would one day not be paid under those contracts. And finally, Your Honor, I would note that even if factor three does not convince, the district court's timeliness analysis merit reversal under a permissive intervention theory and the Hernandez decision from 2023.
Thank you.
So I'll begin where Your Honors left off with my friends on the other side, whether we have a concrete interest. The district court acknowledged that we have a legally protectable interest, and I think that that is indisputable. Our interest in this litigation about the availability of the fiscal year 2020-2021 funds is as legally protectable as the district court's ability to enjoin those funds. The state suggested it's unclear whether the district court below even has jurisdiction over what we need. That might be true if we were here on a breach of contract claim. We are not. The district court absolutely has jurisdiction to modify its injunction, which is what we are seeking. The district court below is who restrained those funds. And if we go to the Northern District of California, and let me actually just jump to impairment or impediment. The federal government says we are not impaired or impeded in protecting our interest in the settlement agreement because we can seek relief from the settlement agreement. In other words, we can get out of it. We can cut it up and burn it. But that's impairment and impediment. We do not want to get out of our settlement agreement or seek relief from our settlement agreement. We want for the federal government to have funding available as it represented it was in order to perform the projects that it committed to undertake. That is practical impairment and impediment, and there are several cases of this court that have acknowledged even less to be practical impairment or impediment. The states say that that interest is contingent. We briefed this question. First, this court has never said that a contingent interest is insufficient. CNA Metals is about a contingency fee agreement that is by definition contingent, and that was a legally protectable interest. But you don't even need a contingency fee or contractual agreement. There is nothing downstream about the impact of the GLO injunction, which restricted the availability of funding, and our settlement agreement. And finally, Your Honor, insofar as the district court erred on the timeliness analysis under intervention by right, it erred in its application of discretion on permissive intervention, and so we ask for reversal on that basis as well. Thank you.
This case is now under submission. Thank you very much. We are adjourned for today.